Kate got back to room 2305 humming, for some reason, exactly the same tune. Jury, who was sitting on her bed with her shoes off watching the late news on TV, smiled as she entered. "Those are pretty earrings," she said, reverting back to Gaulish now that they were alone. "Last-minute present from your father?" "Hmm," said Kate. She put the Beaujolais on the table, then paused in front of the closet door mirror to admire herself. Caitlin wasn't the neurotic sort of girl who was convinced she was ugly when she wasn't. She was comfortable in her skin, behind her face. But it wasn't all that often that she felt particularly pretty, either. Tonight, though, tonight she did, in these clothes, in this place, and the earrings and the chilled pink of her cheeks added just the right final touches. She tried to freeze the image in her mind. Portrait of the artist on her 16th birthday. "Is he coming to the concert tomorrow?" Jury inquired. "No," said Kate as she sat down to take off her shoes. "It's invitation only, and Cam doesn't invite people outside the musical community, except for the participants' guests." "That's a shame," Jury mused. "He wouldn't like it anyway, said Kate lightly. She got a set of her pajamas out of the top drawer of the bureau and went into the bathroom, then emerged a bit later with her earrings in their box, her good clothes neatly arranged on a hanger, and the pajamas on her body in their place. Dad's kind of old-fashioned, she went on, as though she hadn't interrupted herself to change. All this newfangled experimental music. She shook her head with an indulgent smile. He'd be miserable right up until my turn, and I'm on last. Kate hung her clothes in the closet, then went to the little table in the corner, picked up her pocketful of change, and hunted a few small bills out of her wallet. "I'm going to get a soda," said Kate. You want anything?" "I am a little thirsty. Diet Hassie, if you please." Sure. No problem. She dropped the change and small bills into her pajama pocket. Be right back. Kate padded out into the pleasantly decorated, wainscoted, carpeted hall and set off on her mission. Since their arrival, Jury had been handling the ice duties on this trip, so Kate hadn't been to the vending machines so far. Usually they were at the end of the hall, so she headed that way, anticipating an easy victory. Whistling cheerfully, she rounded the corner at the corridor's end, then stopped. Before her stood an ice machine, rumbling happily away, but nothing more. There was no soda machine, nor was there a vacant space where one could have been. Confused, she retraced her steps back to the elevator, then paced up and down the empty hallway on the opposite side. Still no soda machine. She started back toward the ice machine, driven by the same urge that prompts a person to look for the keys where they ought to be for a sixth time, but stopped upon discovering a sign that she had previously failed to notice. Mounted on the wall opposite the elevators, the sign proclaimed, "Distributeur automatique, 25 étage." Okay, thought Caitlin to herself as she called for an elevator. The hotel can't afford a vending machine on every floor. Whatever. When the elevator doors opened, Caitlin stepped inside. After a brief smile and nod to the elderly couple that were already there, she pressed 25. The elevator whirred for a few moments and then opened to reveal a hallway identical to the one she had come from except for the color. The 23rd floor was cream and coral, while the 25th was cream and teal. As promised, there was a vending machine. However, the red lights next to both blue and silver Hassie buttons and the single silver and white Hassie Diet button made it clear that nothing was to be gained by inserting coins. Caitlin let out a growl of annoyance and returned to the elevator. She rode in solitude up to the 27th floor, where she found another machine. This one was a newer model, sporting an image of a can bearing the "I am a beverage of class and dignity" script font logo, rather than the "I am the beverage of the future" block font logo discontinued the previous year. This year's vending machines incorporated newly designed bait-and-switch technology. That is to say, they didn't inform Caitlin that both of her desired products were sold out until after she inserted her money and pressed the buttons. The non-functional coin return was a nice added touch. Kate tried out a French expletive that she had learned but never had occasion to employ, and grudgingly accepted a can of moon mist as a consolation prize. She then stormed back to the elevator. She was unable to access the 29th floor since it required a key, so instead she ventured down to the 21st floor. As the doors closed behind her, Caitlin stared icily at the sign which faced her. Glacé, 23 étage. Distributeur automatique, 19 étage. Sure enough, a quick glance down the hallway confirmed that the 21st floor had no equipment whatsoever in the nominal vending area. What a way to run a railroad, Caitlin muttered. The 19th floor had a soda machine and cheerfully dispensed a can of Hassy, but was sold out of Jury's preferred beverage. Kate briefly considered just getting another Hassy. It's not as if Jury really needed the added benefit of a diet beverage, but discarded the idea. She had promised to come back with a diet Hassy, and that's what she was going to do. Now it was a matter of honor. The machine on the 15th floor sat dark and powerless. Caitlin's next strategy was to bypass the 10th floor, L'Hôtel des Deux Îles being one of those places that refused to admit it had a 13th floor, and sneak up on the unsuspecting beverages from below. She went all the way down to the 2nd floor, the first being listed on the button as C, whatever that stood for, but was greeted by another sold-out machine. The one on the 6th floor looked entirely normal, but would respond to no provocation. At least the coin return worked. The 10th floor was another no ice, no soda, no anything floor, and backtracking to the 8th only turned up a machine whose display bore the ominous message, "Port Service." If the family of American tourists making their way up to the 26th floor was unnerved by the barefoot, scowling girl in the very loud pajamas holding two soda cans under her right arm as she muttered and waved indecisively over the button panel with her left hand, they hid it well. It was on the 17th floor that Caitlin finally found a machine containing, and willing to part with, Jury's preferred beverage. She purchased two, as well as a second Hassy Cola for herself. At least she wouldn't have to go through this ordeal a second time. The extras could go into the ice chest, and at this point she knew exactly where to go to get ice. "There must be a story here," said Jury dryly as Kate entered room 2305, unloaded her pyramidal stack of beverage cans, and picked up the ice chest. "Ugh," said Kate, and she went back out after the ice. Jury looked after her for a moment with a bemused expression, then smiled and cracked open one of the diet Hassies. Kate returned in a slightly better mood, the ice machine not having put up a fight, and told Jury about her ordeal. Just as she finished, the telephone rang. Both glanced at the clock, confirmed that it was midnight, and then looked with almost identical puzzled expressions at the phone. Then Jury answered it and discovered that it was Utina, calling from Worcester, where it was only 6 p.m., with birthday greetings for Kate. She knew, as most of them did back there, that since Kate didn't have to get up until noon Paris time on Friday, she would still be awake now. Kate chatted with her roommate for a few minutes, then Corwin. What was he doing at WPI on a Thursday night? Kate resolved to investigate further when she returned home, since he wasn't volunteering and she didn't feel like breaking up the mood by asking. Then she received greetings from everybody who could be rounded up at WPI as the phone was passed around on that end. Shortly thereafter, Aunt Belle called from Tomodachi, and another round of well wishes came from the Norse branch of the family. Not long after that, it was the turn of Kate's mother and her siblings back in New Avalon, with Marty and Aiko Rose elbowing their way onto the line near the end of the call. Things finally quieted down around 1. Jury found a Maigret movie on the Classic Film Network. They played a few hands of Belote Découverte, a popular French card game, and talked about the week. Finally, at around 3, they turned out the lights, shut off the TV, and settled down in the homey, soft, mismatched quilts of their creaky iron beds and went to sleep. As she drifted off, Caitlin reflected that she'd have to dig back pretty deep to find a better birthday than this had been. As good, maybe, but better? That would take some doing. Halfway to unconsciousness, she turned over in her cocoon of covers, tucked 7 a little more firmly against her chest, and looked across the gap between the beds at Jury. The elder girl didn't curl up when she first went to sleep. She lay on her back with her head tipped back on the pillows, face turned up to the ceiling, her arms along her sides outside the covers. Kate regarded her profile for a few moments in the dim glow of the lights of Paris filtering through the curtains, watching the patchwork of her quilt rise and fall with her breathing. Some people, even rather mature, serious people like Jury tended to be, become children when asleep. Caitlin had often seen the phenomenon on the face of Amanda Dessler, who was usually serious to the point of appearing almost humorless. When Amanda slept, her visage acquired a sort of innocent timelessness that gave her a little girl air. Kate's own mother, an honorary Valkyrie and a veteran of countless battles and 3 childbirths, looked as innocent, carefree, and helpless as a newborn in her sleep. Jury, on the other hand, looked like Jury, only asleep. She had the same perfect, unruffled composure in sleep that she had in wakefulness, the same slightly distant and slightly awesome aspect. There was no vulnerability in it, only a sort of cool remove, like a statue of a goddess in repose. Kate felt a rather silly urge to get up, go over there, and kiss that composed and lovely face and that slim, inviting throat. To smash that shell of remoteness and reserve and taste the warm, vibrant human being she sometimes glimpsed within it. To run her hands along the smoothness of Jury's skin, hold the redhead in her arms, and tell her all the secrets in the world. But if she kept thinking that way, she'd never get to sleep, and she had a big day tomorrow. So she turned over again, exchanging that view for the blankness of the bathroom wall, and sighed the sigh of a girl who knows, or thinks she knows, that she's contending in the wrong weight class. The lyrics to a new song were wandering through her brain as she shut it down. Kate rose at noon, dressed in her gray suit, put on her maple leaf earrings, and left the Hotel des Deux Îles carrying the smaller of her 2 bags. Jury had nothing to do with herself until 7 that night, when the International Conference of Modern Composers' closing ceremonies began at the Centre Pompidou. Well, almost nothing. Once Kate had gone, the redhead spent a few minutes examining her invitation to the concert and reception, surveyed her formal wear options, and decided they could be improved upon. She arrived at the Centre Pompidou at 6:40, and since she was a bit early, she took the time to stand outside across the street and, well, admire wasn't really the right word. The Centre Georges Pompidou was perhaps the ugliest building Jury had ever seen, so comically hideous that she couldn't quite believe the architects had really meant for it to look like that. To Jury, it looked more or less like a warehouse that the construction crew had walked away from when they'd about half finished it. It was a long, low box covered with metal tube scaffolding and exposed support beams, and sporting a rather incongruous canopied escalator running up one of its sides. This had apparently been a bold architectural statement of some kind in the 1970s, when the building was raised. And now, of course, it was an historical cultural icon, and so couldn't be pulled down no matter how much of an eyesore it was. Reflecting that perhaps it did indeed take all kinds to make a world, Jury entered the building, which had the same ragtag, deliberately half-finished feel on the inside, and found her way to the underground auditorium. Upon surveying the other guests gathered there, she decided she had made the right decision in mounting a new formal wear expedition. The 1,000 or so people present ranged quite widely, from the affectedly disaffected youths in black leather and duct tape, who were constantly talking in tiredly disgusted tones about the bourgeoisie, to the more traditional symphony types in black tie and tails, the women in frilly, bustly, ruffly dresses as elaborately constructed as public works projects, dripping with conspicuous jewels. In her simple, broad-strapped, low-necked, wasp-waisted gown of cream-colored satin, elbow-length matching gloves, and a string of unembellished pearls, Jury prowled among them with a very faint and self-satisfied smile. She was elegant but understated, somehow managing to make the anti-formal proles and the overdressed bourgeois look equally trashy when compared alongside her. Monsieur Karl Chalfant, a very boring middle-aged man wearing a tuxedo and a shirt so stiffly starched it almost looked like it might crack if he bent down, welcomed all to the 67th annual Conférence Internationale des Modernes Compositeurs, a program of 10 musical compositions representing what he described as the very best that the finest modern composers and performers in the civilized galaxy have to offer, followed his interminable opening remarks. Of the first 9 pieces played, Jury enjoyed 5, was interested by but didn't enjoy 1, an extremely intricate all-percussion piece by an ensemble from Granval 4, which was technically very intriguing but hurt her ears, was indifferent to 2, and completely loathed the 9th. This was the offering of the École Musico-Technologique. Owing to its extreme complexity and reliance on modern recording and signal combination techniques, it could not be performed live. It had to be played from an optical crystal. The honor of introducing it, queuing it up, and kicking it off went to the lanky, haughty, slightly greasy young man, maybe 2 or 3 years older than Jury from the looks of him, who apparently bore only the single name Ragoulin. When Caitlin had described her impressions of the École Musico-Technologique's output, Jury had assumed she was exaggerating for comic effect, and possibly also out of a sense of rivalry with this Ragoulin character. But no. No, it was, if anything, worse than Kate had said. It went on for nearly half an hour. Various scraping, twanging, whirring noises overlaid one atop another until they blended into something that sounded rather like Jury imagined a ramjet would sound like if it tried to play the bagpipes, interspersed with utterly random, spasmodic electro-drums and gravelly samples of people saying very dire-sounding things in mixed German and French. When it ended, there was no warning. It merely stopped, as though the crystal had run out of recording capacity in mid-muddle, leaving a deafening, stunned silence in the auditorium. This lasted for perhaps 5 long, uneasy seconds, after which the black-clad, would-be socially disenfranchised Marxist anarchists began applauding furiously, all 5 of them. Everyone else remained silent, their faces fixed in looks that varied from disgust to disbelief to slightly pained social awkwardness, as if they had just witnessed an acquaintance commit a monumental faux pas at a party and didn't know quite how to react. Ragoulin got stiffly up from his seat, retrieved the data crystal from the playback deck, held it up so that it glittered in the stage lights, and declared loudly, "This is the future of Earth's music! Don't you understand? 15,000 years of human cultural evolution has been leading up to this!" "Then may God save the people of the earth, young man," a gruff voice called anonymously from somewhere in the largest mass of formally dressed visitors. A laugh made it around the assembly, in spots uncomfortable, in others hearty. The 5 youths in black got up and left in a hurry, as, with a muttered imprecation about Philistines, did Ragoulin.
Well, said Monsieur Chalfant uneasily from the podium, "yes, well, for those of you whose tastes are somewhat less, shall we say, Catholic?"
"Shall we say, terrible?" said the waggish voice, drawing another laugh.
If you please, Monsieur Statler," said Chalfant in a tone somewhere between embarrassed, guiltily amused, and admonitory, "we have one final performance for you this evening, of a somewhat more traditional type. Here from the United States to perform her Sonata for Piano No. 14 in G, please welcome the student director of the Worcester Preparatory Institute Orchestra, Miss Caitlin Hutchins."
Kate emerged from the wings at stage right, and Jury, sitting in the front row, blinked in surprise. Where had she gotten that dress? Jury certainly hadn't bought it for her, but looking at it now, she rather wished she had. Black silk with orange trim, a tight-fitting little bar-button jacket and black roll-cuffed gloves. It was really quite lovely, if in a style Jury found somewhat unusual. She made a mental note to interrogate Kate about it later. Now Kate stepped up to the front of the stage, next to Chalfant, and bowed with her hands clasped before her in a fashion that reminded Jury of home. Then she turned and murmured something to Chalfant, who smiled and addressed the microphone again. "Mademoiselle Caitlin has asked me to mention the help she has received in perfecting this piece from her friend, colleague, and student deputy at WPI, Monsieur Miki Kaworu, whose responsibilities at the Institute prevented him from attending the conference." Jury smiled. That was just like Kate, wasn't it? To share credit even when no one would have known the difference if she hadn't? Kate bowed again, then turned and went to the grand piano, which stood off to the left, set up out of the way of the grand valise drummers, who had needed a lot of space. She sat down, took off her gloves, and laid them on the bench beside her, composed herself for a moment, and then began to play. Being a friend of Miki, Jury had heard solo piano compositions many, many times in her life. She didn't know much about musical theory or structure, but nevertheless, she thought she could recognize the flavor of his touch in a few places in the piece Caitlin played that night, seamlessly fused with the brown-haired girl's own distinctive style. The thought that, after only a few days or hours or minutes of acquaintance, hadn't Utina said he'd started helping Kate with one of her compositions the very day, the very hour the two had met? Music could produce such a blending of arts, of souls, made Jury stop and think for a moment about the power that this medium held. The piano could bring two people together so closely that their voices became one. Or it could, she knew from Miki's own history, make enemies of a brother and his sister. What tremendous power. She abandoned that train of thought, settled back in her seat, and listened to the music rather than dwelling on the stories behind it. It seemed to tell a story itself, one of damaged happiness reforged in the fires of a great trial. That was a rather fanciful interpretation, perhaps, but that was the way it made Jury feel. She wondered, as Kate finished the towering crescendo that led to the piece's climax, if the pianist had written it before or after learning Utina's story. If after, then it was a bold bit of prediction, wasn't it? Caitlin as seeress, truth saying the future with a piano instead of a crystal ball? The applause when Caitlin finished was rather more immediate and heartfelt than that which had followed her piece's predecessor, and when she stood to take her bow, she was flushed with triumph, like a runner who has just won a race. For her, and for Miki, unknowing and thousands of miles away, Jury stood up, bringing the room with her, and made her appreciation known, of the music itself, and of all the thoughts and insights it had caused to race across her mind while it played. They ditched the post-concert reception as early as was even vaguely decent, with sly smiles and silent conspiracy, and ate their own celebratory dinner at Fouquet's on the Champs-Élysées. Caitlin was buoyant to the point of nearly floating away, what with the success of her performance, the compliment she'd received on Aunt Belle's dress from Jury, and the way Jury looked herself, oh my. Dinner at the historic, elegant, and very expensive restaurant after such an occasion felt almost like a date, even if she hadn't asked and Jury hadn't answered the question that kept rattling around in the back of Kate's head. Yet even without that, Kate felt a bursting sort of pride that this lovely, sophisticated creature would be willing to be seen in a place like this with her, would talk to her, laugh with her, congratulate her on her moral victory over the forces of cacophony. How did Ragoulin end up on the selection committee anyway? Jury wondered as they waited for their soup. "He's the senior attendee from the Ecole," said Kate. A couple of Urquhart's directors take the Ecole seriously enough to keep inviting them, and Ragoulin's their bright young star. A true visionary, they call him. "He can't be much older than we are."
He isn't,
Kate confirmed, nodding.
I think he's a sophomore in college. But the Ecole and parts of Irkem think he's a real prodigy, so...
Kate shrugged.
"Monsieur Chalfant and Mr. Statler, he's the conductor of the Boston Pops, a dear man, but a bit on the crusty side. He was the one who was heckling Raguelin.
Mm-hmm, said Kate.
He and Raguelin really dislike each other. It's kind of funny. Anyway, he and Monsieur Chalfant are always on the committee, and between them they balance out Raguelin. He's really not so bad, anyway. Kind of a prick, but I get the feeling he might grow out of it. If somebody tied him to a chair and made him listen to good music for a few weeks.
Jury laughed.
A service to all mankind, she said.
Their conversation left the politics of Urcam behind after that. They ate and drank wine and talked of Jury's days in Paris while Kate worked at the conference, of their evenings together sampling the city, and of their plans and hopes for the upcoming school term. Caitlin asked where Jury was planning to spend the summer holidays. Jury, surprised, replied that she hadn't even considered that yet, but that she might get an apartment there in town, or perhaps in New Avalon, the city of which she was a citizen, but which she had never yet seen. Kate smiled at that and said that she and Utina would certainly be glad if she lived close by through the summer. Utina, of course, would be staying with her at her father's house. This prompted Jury to remark that she'd welcome the opportunity to speak at greater length with Kate's father, at some time when she wouldn't be intruding on a special occasion. Did she understand correctly that the man was over 400 years old? Indeed she did, and the explanation of that took much of the rest of the meal. They finished dessert, settled the bill without examining it too closely, and left the restaurant almost arm in arm. The night was much warmer than the evening before, unseasonably so, as they strolled side by side down the broad sidewalk of the Champs-Élysées toward the Place de la Concorde in their formal gowns of satin and silk, the redhead in cream, and the brunette in black and orange.
"Where did you get that dress?"
Jury inquired quietly, smiling privately as she did so at the sight of a young man in a waiter's white waistcoat, nearly tripping over a café-side curbstone as he tried to watch them while still performing his duties.
"Aunt Belle made it for me," Kate replied.
Then, her cheeks coloring faintly, she added, "Do you like it?" Jury nodded.
"It's very becoming," she said.
"A bit more daring than I'd have expected from you," she added with a slightly indulgent smile, "what with the sides and all."
Kate's faint coloring deepened a little.
You should see it without the jacket. The neckline on the dress itself is about here," she said, holding a flattened hand at the approximate level of the jacket's second button.
Jury raised an eyebrow.
"My, my," she said. "Though the jacket has its own charms," she went on. "It makes the whole thing a little more exotic than it would be if it were just a gown with a bold neckline. Quirky, but charming. Very you. Your aunt understands a thing or two about tailing the style to the wearer."
She grinned and pointed discreetly to a gentleman who had just nearly walked into a lamp post.
"Even with the jacket on, you're causing accidents."
Kate's little touch of color upgraded itself to a full-on blush. After a few moments, she managed to murmur,
"It's you they're looking at."
"Partly," Jury allowed nonchalantly, "but not entirely." In fact, Jury thought she rather envied Caitlin, in a way. The brown-haired girl could choose to be striking or not. She was always pretty, and as she'd demonstrated tonight, with the right dress and a little work, she could be considerably more, but she didn't have to be. If she wanted to go back to being just pleasant to look at, all she had to do was change, and that gave her more impact when she did do herself up as she'd done tonight. But there wasn't really a way of saying that which didn't stand a good chance of being misinterpreted as an insult, so Jury left it unsaid, and merely smiled to herself at the thought. For Caitlin's part, the lateness of the hour—it was nearly midnight—the emotional and mental efforts of the day, the food and wine, the beauty of the city, and the surprising warmth of the realization that Jury had just complimented her on her looks blended her buoyant mood down to something more like a contented lassitude, and she knew that it was time for bed. They hailed a taxi at the Rue du Colisée, one of the funny little black ones. It almost had the flavor of a dream as the cab carried them from the gleaming bustle of the Champs-Élysées to the calm and quiet of the Île Saint-Louis, and Kate was feeling very warm and sleepy in a deeply satisfied kind of way as they rode the elevator to the 23rd floor. Still, after changing to her pajamas and brushing her teeth, she did manage to stay awake long enough to murmur in the darkness, "Jury?" "Hmm?" Jury replied. Kate turned over to face her and smiled drowsily through the darkness across the gap between the beds.
Thank you for coming," she said. It's made this trip really special."
Barely visible in the dark, Jury smiled. "You're welcome, Caitlin," she said.
Say, Kate went on, and then she stopped,
half hoping Jury hadn't heard her, half praying that she'd ask.
"Yes?"
Kate paused, her cheeks feeling hot, drowsiness and lingering euphoria drowning away some but not all of her trepidation. Then she continued,
"Are we friends?"
There was a pause, just long enough to make the first faint tickle of dread. "Oh no, I've gone too far. I've asked too much. I've ruined everything," touch Caitlin's heart. But then Jury's voice came, and there was still a smile in it.
"Yes, Caitlin, I believe we are."
Relief rushed through Kate like a wave through the pilings of a pier, and knocked away the last props of tension holding her in something like wakefulness. She burrowed a little deeper into her covers, the smile on her sleepy face becoming a little dreamy, and she replied,
"Good. I'm glad. Good night, Jury."
"Good night, Caitlin," said Jury, but Kate was already asleep. Jury smiled and closed her eyes as well. The first time she had ever seen Kate, she had been in the same warm, happy, semi-conscious state. Even though she'd only known the girl for a month, the memory made her feel pleasantly nostalgic.
"Aw, that's sweet. You brought me a redhead. Good night."
Jury chuckled wryly at herself. Just the random mental wanderings of a sleepy mind, roused from who knew what sort of pleasant dreams, and still half experiencing them in midstream, of course. It meant nothing. Kind of a shame, really. Ah, well. On Saturday morning, Kate and Jury rose refreshed and energized, put on traveling clothes, and went to the Gare du Nord to catch a Euromag Levitrain to London. They didn't do anything in particular there, just wandered around looking at buildings and talking, and getting odd looks from the people in the street until they realized that, out of pure habit, they'd been talking French. They just felt like being able to say that they'd gone. Why not? The train ride through the French and English countrysides, and the Eurotunnel, only took an hour each way, and watching those countrysides whip past at nearly 400 miles an hour was quite an experience all by itself. Though they traveled much more slowly than the suborbital shuttle that brought them to Europe in the first place had gone, it was also much more immediate when you were screaming along 6 inches above the rails. They got back to Paris at 5-ish, just in time to take advantage of the Gare du Nord's location to walk up Montmartre to Sacré-Cœur, climb the dome, and enjoy its famous view of the city at nightfall. Then, just for the hell of it, it was a just-for-the-hell-of-it sort of day, they attended the Basilica's 6 o'clock mass before walking back down the hill and catching the metro back downtown. On the Île de la Cité, they dined at the Brasserie Dauphine one last time. The Janviers and the three cops from the special squad were almost like old friends now, and the parting at the end of the meal was pleasant but a trifle sad. They walked the Quai des Orfèvres one last time, too. Jury was struck by how odd it was that something done only 2 or 3 times could get to feel like a habit, how something done for the first time less than a week before could already evoke nostalgia. But there it was. They went to Bertillon, the world-famous ice cream shop on the Rue Saint-Louis-en-l'Île, not far from their hotel, and indulged themselves shamelessly. Then they just walked at random around central Paris, as they had done in London earlier that day, enjoying the sights and sounds of the city around them, and feeling the pleasant but piquant satisfaction that comes in the winding-down phase of a successful vacation. Having decided to stay up all night in order to beat jet lag, since they would be leaving Paris at 6 a.m. and arriving in Worcester at about 2, they ended up sitting at a café in the Rue des Écoles at around 1 in the morning, drinking strong coffee and watching the students of the Quartier Latin on their weekend missions. Intense young men with sketch pads, pretty girls in combat boots and jeans, brightly decked hipsters of both sexes hurried here and there on their way to who knows what. Presently a couple of girls came in together, the one tall and handsome, raven-haired and Roman-nosed, in jeans and a honey-colored turtleneck sweater, the other a gray-skinned, white-haired, slim and coltish Nibari girl, festooned with bangles and black leather. They took a corner table, held hands, and whispered conspiratorially, giggling and occasionally stealing kisses as they drank tea and read from a textbook propped up on the table in front of them. Jury raised an eyebrow and mused, "Interesting." "Hmm?" said Kate, who had been looking down the street at a young man wearing the most remarkably ugly suit jacket she thought she had ever seen in her life. "Those two in the corner," said Jury. "Not very discreet, are they?" Kate looked, then shrugged. "Why should they be? They're in Paris and in love." She smiled, sipped her coffee, and added, "I can't think of anything better." "I suppose," Jury said. "It's just a bit startling to see, right out in public like that. It wasn't done back home. Men and women, yes, but..." She gave a wry smile and added, "I guess I'm a little shocked." I think it's nice, said Kate. Maybe I'll write a song about them. Two young women in love, with Paris and their whole lives spread out in front of them, like the pages of their shared textbook. She gestured vaguely. Jury smiled, nodded, filed that fact fragment away somewhere, and finished her coffee in a speculative frame of mind. Then the pair of them went back to their room, changed into their nightclothes, packed their suitcases, and hunted up a movie on TV to kill the remaining time before they would have to leave the Hotel des Deux Îles behind and make the trek out to De Gaulle and their flight back to the United States. It was 2:12 in the morning, Worcester time, when Caitlin and Jury said goodnight to each other in the hallway on the fourth floor of Morgan Hall. They were too fried by now to dwell much on what a good week it had been, so they merely smiled at each other and let the smiles carry with them all the things they both knew the other wanted to say, then entered their respective rooms on opposite sides of the hall. In both cases, their roommates were asleep and didn't wake to the sounds of keys and locks and the slashes of light that cut across the floors and were extinguished again by the openings and closings of the doors. Jury put down her suitcases, changed into her nightdress in the dark, and left everything until morning in favor of climbing into bed and going immediately to sleep. Caitlin followed almost the same procedure, putting on her pajamas and taking a moment to unpack 7. Unlike Morgan 413, where the beds were on opposite sides of the room, the beds in Morgan 412 were bunked, and Caitlin paused at the base of the ladder to look smilingly into the bottom bunk at the sleeping face of her roommate. Utina was one of those people whose cares and worries all vanished from her face in sleep, not that they tended to ride her all that visibly when she was awake, and it gave Caitlin a distinct and powerful feeling of homecoming to look on that face, faintly lit by the glow from her alarm clock and barred by the lights of the quad through the Venetian blinds. Paris was beautiful, but this place, this room, this girl, this was home. Kate impulsively leaned down and kissed her roommate's forehead. At the contact, Utina stirred, murmured, and then opened her eyes slowly. Recognizing Kate, she smiled a bit blurrily. "Hey," she said, raising a languid hand to brush Kate's face as the standing girl stepped back a bit. I'm sorry, Kate whispered. I didn't mean to wake you.
It's okay, Utrina replied in a sleepy murmur. How is Paris?
Good, said Kate. I'll tell you all about it tomorrow.
Okay, said Utrina. It's good to have you home.
Kate smiled. It's good to be home, she replied.
Good night.
Night, said Utrina, who was asleep before Kate reached her top bunk, let alone settled in. Yeah, it was good to be home.
This concludes The Rose That Blooms in the City of Light. The symphony will return.